This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Tuesday night in San Francisco, in the only ballpark regularly filled with people who could be counted on to be thoroughly delighted with his achievement, Barry Bonds hit a pitch which had been making its way toward the plate at 84 miles per hour into the right center field seats some 435 feet from home plate. It was the 756th home run of his career. Nobody has hit more. As has become his custom, Bonds watched the ball soar toward the stands, then he raised his hands over his head, and finally he began jogging around the bases. Later, Bonds, who has been accused of using steroids and lying about it, would say, "The record is not tainted at all, period." Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, who was not in San Francisco, called to congratulate Bonds after the game. Henry Aaron, whose place Bonds has now taken at the top of the home run list, had taped a congratulatory video, which played on the stadium's video board during a 10-minute tribute to the new home run champion. Joining me now from NPR's New York studios are Donald Dewey and Nicholas Acocella, co-authors of The Biographical History of Baseball. Gentlemen, you know obviously that baseball is full of records, but in a game where most people agree that pitching is the most important element, why has the career home run record become the most significant statistic?
Two words, Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth outstripped the previous record back in the 20s by so many home runs that it became the centerpiece of statistical baseball.
Yeah, but Cy Young won over 500 games, you know, and it's still a big deal in our current contemporary baseball days when a pitcher wins 300.
The way pitchers approach the game is in inverse proportion to – the way we approach pitchers in the game is in inverse proportion to how we approach hitters. And when we started treating hitters as golden – statistically, in the Babe Ruth era, we started downplaying pitching statistics.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, the career home run record is kind of like, well, Times Square New Year's Eve. It's the ultimate 5-4-3-2-1, and it more or less celebrates baseball's own obsession with statistics. If you want to talk about what is the single greatest record in baseball history, it's, as Nick said, it's a pitching record.
Yeah.
It's Jack Taylor.
Right.
He completed 187 complete games in a row. Now, that one is never going to be touched. Joe DiMaggio, forget Joe DiMaggio, forget Johnny Vandermeer, because somewhere along the line, somebody is going to pitch three consecutive no-hitters. Somebody's going to hit in 57 straight games. But nobody is ever even going to, you know, pitch 87 complete games, let alone 187.
Because we've stopped thinking about pitching the way they thought about it in Jack Taylor's day, which was right after the turn of the century. Now we train guys to go six innings. Six innings, when I was a kid in the 50s, would have been a sissy pitcher. I mean, nobody would have wanted him.
Yeah, it was Bob Rush. We used to call him Bob Rush.
Yeah, there you go, Bob Rush. Certainly not Robin Roberts, who would start 35 games, pitch 300 innings, and relieve in between starts. I mean, we just think about it differently. Hitters are still expected to go up there and hit home runs.
Has any breaker of a significant baseball record ever been as coolly received as Bonds has been, at least outside San Francisco?
No, probably. Well, I mean, I don't know what, you know, what was the exact reaction in the Connor household when Babe Ruth, you know, used a lively ball to beat Connor's record.
Yeah.
But we are so surrounded by the hype and have been for so long about any of this that we've created this fantasy out there about, you know, like, well, this is, you know, this is not real pure baseball that's happening. Well, you know, we've said many times, you've got to judge baseball as separate things. It was one kind of a game when Ruth was playing. It was another kind of game when Connor before him was playing. It was another kind of game when Aaron was playing. And now it's another kind of game with Bonds. I mean, some of the same people who are just absolutely frothing at the mouth every time they hear Barry Bonds' name. You know, I mean, reporters, look at their medicine cabinets at home. I mean, these are people who are living in a different kind of world. I mean, how many ball players? I mean, like, leaving aside the fact that, I mean, anybody who takes steroids, you know, needs a keeper. But the fact of the matter is, how many ball players have died in recent years because of drugs? Gee, I can only think of one. And he died in a car crash because of what? Was it steroids? No. He died in a car crash because he boozed too much. But we're not going to take on Coors and Miller's and Bud and all of these, you know, sponsors of big league baseball. No, we're going to go after something else.
Why is it that this controversy with Bonds has kicked up so much more discussion, especially and dismay, outside of San Francisco than, say, Gaylord Perry wins 300 games, admits that he put everything he could find onto the ball?
You said it at the top of the show. It's the home run record. The Gaylord Perry thing, I mean, everybody treated it as a joke. It's funny. I mean, look, people are going to cheat. When winning is important, people are going to cheat. How they cheat is a matter of, I guess, preference and upbringing. But the spitball stuff, we don't even take that seriously anymore, because we know we could all three of us could name a dozen pitchers who've done it, and those are the ones we know.
Not only are people going to cheat, but they're going to have their cheating underwritten by the commissioner's office and by the Players Association, which was going on in the 90s.
Well, let me ask you another question then, because the I don't get it is fascinating to me. Why has there been such national wringing of hands and dismay about Bonds' behavior?
Because the sports and sports writing establishment love to wring their hands. They love sanctimoniousness.
Inside that, you've got a couple of factors. Number one factor, of course, is, and I hate to say this because I don't want to personalize it, there's a lot more involved in it, but Bud Selig's love affair with Hank Aaron has been going on since the Braves moved to Milwaukee, okay? And Selig was going to do anything to protect that, and still would. Number two, Bonds is, as a personality, is just completely
fuzzy,
you know,
and warm. He's not.
Yeah. And the only one who compares with him is probably his ex-teammate, Jeff Kent. So, I mean, you've got a combination of a guy who is not, sitcom pleasant. You've got a commissioner who really, really not only hates the idea that his boyhood hero, or actually he wasn't even a boy, he was his middle-aged
hero. Well, his boyhood has lasted a long time.
Yes, I guess so.
Yeah.
Then you've got, frankly, his own embarrassment about what he encouraged in the 1990s. I think all of this is, if we can, land this on Barry Bonds' head, we're all going to be happy about it.
Given the way that you've characterized Bonds, and given all that's been written about the characters and ruffians who populated the game, back during the Ruth and Cobb eras, maybe it's a shame that Barry Bonds didn't play back then. Maybe he'd have felt more comfortable and at home if he'd played at a time when this was kind of the ethos of the game.
He might have. I mean, I always maintain that if we're going to, decide who goes into the Hall of Fame on moral grounds, we got to get rid of a whole lot of people. A whole lot of people. I think we get it down basically to Lou Gehrig, all alone in the inner sanctum.
Yeah, I mean, and plus, don't forget this. There is, if you put aside, the spoutings of somebody like Schilling every once in a while, the ball players who have played for, with, and against Bonds, there's nobody out there rooting against him that I've heard. They all absolutely appreciate what he's done, whether or not they themselves are taking steroids. I mean, if you're talking anybody from a Glavin to Russ Martin, Martin, the new catcher in Los Angeles, they look at him in awe. And frankly, they know better than you or I know what's been going on.
Look, we live in a society where performance-enhancing drugs are all over the place. People take it to have sex. What are we upset about this for? Because the guy is breaking a home run record where that's somehow different? I mean, they're all
then having
the
sex?
Well, actually, for some people,
for some people,
no,
not. Yeah, you're right. You're right. And there are a whole other host of factors here. Nothing in the past 30 years, no ruling in baseball, no construction in baseball has favored pitchers. We got lower mounds. We got a dozen and a half new ballparks that are hitters parks.
Smaller strike zones.
Smaller strike zone. Exactly. There's a whole lot of things conspiring to make this happen. Do the performance and, do the drugs that make your head and your feet bigger help? Yeah. Is it the whole story? I don't think so.
Speculate for me about Bonds' position in the kind of baseball constellation. How will he be regarded by fans, by historians, etc.? Should there be an asterisk?
God, no.
Absolutely not.
Don Dewey and Nicholas Acocella are the authors of The Biographical History of Baseball. Gentlemen, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
That last home run, Hank was going some when he hit the last home run.
Thank you, Mike Baksik, for throwing a hittable strike on a 3-2 count in the fifth inning on Tuesday night. Under the same circumstances, a lesser man might have thrown ball four, choosing to sidestep the designation of the guy who threw the gopher ball that allowed Barry Bonds to ascend to the top of the heap of home run hitters. The chase had gone on long enough. Even the people most distressed by the fact that the career home run record would be held by a man suspected of using performance-enhancing drugs and lying about it had begun to hope Barry Bonds would, for the love of Aaron, hit a couple and end that forced march. This is too bad. The celebration of a new record, especially one as grand and glittering as this one, should feature horns and colorful bunting rather than an almost nationwide sigh of resignation. Almost, because in San Francisco, lots of people still regard Barry Bonds as unassailable, if not untarnished. Throughout the portion of the Aaron chase that has occurred on the road, Barry Bonds has maintained that everything except answering the same questions every day has been exciting. Maybe so, though it's more likely that what he's feeling now is not excitement and satisfaction at what he's accomplished, but relief that the grind is over, and perhaps dread at what comes next. How could it be otherwise? A grand jury looking into the charges of perjury and tax evasion against Bonds has just been extended for another 6 months. The Home Run King's retirement, when it comes, will bring a new round of arguments about the clear and the cream and the murky world of chemicals, chemists, and crooked sidekicks, incarcerated and not, who have served the new champ. What do we say now? Long live the king? May he avoid indictment? Then there will come the hemming, hawing, and harumphing over whether the man who's hit more home runs than anybody else should join the man who had more base hits than anybody else as a pariah with regard to baseball's Hall of Fame. We didn't particularly need the reminder, but the achievement of Barry Bonds has emphasized once more that even when our games should be most fun, they're not all fun and games. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next on Only a Game, A Man Named El Loco and Naked Workouts. Sounds horrifying, but first, when Russ Bradford was an assistant basketball coach at the University of Texas at El Paso and later New Mexico State University, he lived with a secret. Actually, two secrets. He loved to read and write, and he had a passion for the fiddle. As Ireland seemed a satisfactory place to pursue both the writing and the fiddle playing, Russ Bradford decided to relocate. To make a living while he was there, Bradford determined that he would continue to coach basketball, and therein lies the tale titled Paddy on the Hardwood, A Journey in Irish Hoops. Coach Bradford appeared on Only a Game last December, and I asked, how did he even know there was professional basketball in Ireland?
Well, I'd gone over there on holiday in 2001, and just by chance I met the Olympic coach. And I was having a wonderful time on vacation. At the time, Bill, I didn't realize it. Just because I was having a wonderful time on vacation did not necessarily mean it would be a good place to get a job. I think if we all did that, you'd be a bartender in Daytona Beach now, and I'd be on Padre Island working in a surf shop. But I had such a great time, I asked the Olympic coach, a man at the time, the man's name was Bill Dooley, who was the Olympic coach at the time, and he had said, there are a couple teams that pay, but he tried to talk me out of it and told me it would be a dead end and it would be too frustrating. And I was having such a good time on vacation, I just didn't believe him.
How did the game you discovered in Tralee, County Kerry, differ from the game that had employed you as an assistant coach, really at the top level of college basketball here in the States?
Well, at UTEP and New Mexico State, the commitment by both the administration and the fans and the media, but especially by the players, would have been much different than the commitment of the players in Tralee. You know, what I found with the Irish players is that if they had a broken nose or a bent finger or, blood running down their eye, that was fine. They would continue to play through that. But they might miss practice because of their cousin's christening or their office work party. They would miss practice for any possible excuse. But once they were committed and involved and in the fight, they were extremely, extremely tough guys.
To what extent were the teams in the league in Ireland dependent for their success on players from the U.S.?
Well, every team in Ireland is allowed to import two American players, and that's sort of the standard rule for all European teams. They get two imports. It doesn't have to be an American, but you're allowed two guys that don't have Irish passports. And so in Ireland, what you're going to get, because the money is so little, it was maybe $250 or $300 a week, what you're going to get is either a player on the way up or a player on the way down. But I have to add there, Bill, that what you would get also for an imported coach would be a coach on the way up, or like me, maybe a coach on the way down also.
Yeah, I was going to wonder about that. I mean, two assistant jobs at fairly high-profile universities. Any temptation after Ireland to get back into the rat race of college basketball?
Bill, I think about it all the time. I'm like the alcoholic that keeps walking past the pub. You know, I think about college basketball a lot, and it's really the only thing I know how to do to make money. It certainly won't be in the book business, I'm afraid. But that was part of the irony that caught me and Patty on the hardwood was I thought that because I'd worked for Don Haskins and Lou Henson, that this would be easy, that I would just go over there and clean up and sweep through the Irish Super League and it wouldn't be much effort. And most importantly, that I wouldn't get emotionally involved, that I could keep my distance and just do it as a job and not let it swallow me up like it had in my 14 years in Division I basketball.
Well, I understand that one of the reasons you didn't want to be swallowed up by basketball in Ireland was you wanted to go to pubs as often as possible to hear great Irish music and learn to play the stuff on the fiddle and, of course, take fiddle lessons yourself. And you've got your fiddle with you. Is that right?
That's right. And I was self-taught and kind of a hack player. I'm an advanced hack now. But part of the charm of Ireland to me was I thought this will be the chance for me to take my first private fiddle lessons. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of stumbled on a reclusive, nearly a hermit, an old County Kerry fiddle player named Paddy Jones, and he became my teacher.
Well, we better hear something about what Mr. Jones taught you to do.
Well, I think maybe if I can do it now, I'll play a slide from County Kerry, a typical...
That was just spectacular, and I'm sure Patty would be proud.
Well, that's one of Patty's tunes that he taught me. And that style, that's the slide, which is in 12/8 time, is peculiar to County Kerry, where I was living.
In your first season coaching in Tralee, your team came in dead last. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. And in your second season, the Tigers won everything, national champs. Would there have been a book if they hadn't done that?
Well, I thought for a long time, for a few months, I thought, I'll try and make a book out of our last place season, because Kellogg's Frosted Flakes was our sponsor, the Frosties. Frosties are what the Irish call Frosted Flakes.
Mm-hmm.
We were the Frosties Tigers, and Kellogg's dumped us, and it looked like we had no team. But, you know, Bill, in a lot of ways, they say, somebody who's a smart person said that history's written by the winners and literature's written by the losers. We were definitely the losers, and I think that's why most of the book focuses on our losing season. I think it's less self-congratulatory for one thing, but I think it made for a better story, and the tragedy, but also the irony of, you know, as the team got worse and worse and worse and we started losing more and more and we were in a tailspin and we couldn't get out of it. But the irony was that I started liking my players better then.
Russ, you write about how coaching the Tigers reminded you of what you had loved about basketball. Why did you need reminding?
Well, I, w- my story is not unusual, I don't think. I was a burned-out college coach. I think a lot of college coaches burn out and just keep doing it anyway, mm-hmm. and they're not as effective, or they make mistakes, or they just don't do as good a job or don't spend as much time. I burned out, and I'm very much a type A, hyper, hard-driven person. But it's, you know, in America, I think it's safe to say that basketball is completely overemphasized. When we can, when we get 10 pages of color pictures in the sports section, and we have television stations that are devoted completely to sports. In Ireland, basketball was really in the place that it ought to be in society. It was sort of very far down. The players did it because they loved basketball. The small amount of fans who came did it because they loved it. And I wound up doing it because I liked the game, not because of the money or the prestige or the glamour or the chance to be a head Division I coach somewhere else. And so in a way, it brought back the purity to me. I think the reason that most, I don't want to speak for other coaches, but I would imagine that if you asked Jim Calhoun at UConn or the Boston College coach why they got into coaching basketball, it would not be the same reason as why they continue to coach.
Russ Bradford is the author of Paddy on the Hardwood, A Journey in Irish Hoops, published by University of New Mexico Press. He joined me from KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Russ, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you a lot.
Precisely twice a week, we run across a news item that's too irresistible to ignore, but too silly to deserve more than a minute of airtime. After all, we need all the space possible for the important and hard-hitting stories on skillet tossing and belt sander racing. Thus, we have the info break. You may have already heard them. However, you may be listening to the program on a station that uses our info break minutes for more important things, like local traffic, weather, or public service announcements. Whatever the case, sit back and enjoy the stories of naked gymnasiums, an Uber-dedicated coach, and the intrepid El Loco. Perhaps the first scheduled naked workout session at Fit World Gym in Heteren, the Netherlands, could not be considered entirely successful. Though 8 women had signed up for exercise, none showed up, and the dozen middle-aged and elderly gentlemen ready to sweat were outnumbered by the journalists, photographers, and TV crews. The staff of the gym cautioned exercisers to put towels on the weight machines and disposable seat covers on the stationary bikes. Each of the staff members wore a special apron with a nude body painted on it, either to make the nude exercisers more comfortable or because they just thought it would be funny.
Why do they always take the guy's name? As she prepared to marry Greg Marshall, that was what Adrienne Foley wanted to know about brides. She thought Greg Foley had a nicer ring to it than Adrienne Marshall. Mr. Marshall did not agree, and the couple agreed to settle the issue by playing a round of miniature golf. Despite playing in her wedding dress, the former Ms. Foley frightened her betrothed by acing the ninth hole, but Mr. Marshall won match by several shots. "He won, so I have to take his name," Mrs. Marshall said. But how do you suppose her husband felt when she added, "Next time, it's pool"?
Today is the day when he'll meet his match. While we're playing around, it is me he'll catch. We'll be a twosome forevermore. He's my
daughter. I've got a bike, you can ride it if you like it.
Lance Armstrong, move aside. Quickly! Tim Pickens, the president of the rocket design firm Orion Propulsion, has built a rocket-powered bicycle that can go from 0 to 60 in 5 seconds, which is fast enough so that a bike can beat a Porsche in a drag race. The Rocket Bike features a 200-pound thrust engine that uses roofing tar for fuel. Anyone foolish enough to ride the hellacious machine can ignite the fuel by pushing a button on the left handlebar to spark the ignition of a model rocket motor, which proceeds to vaporize the roofing tar, which ignites and powers the bike on down the road. Of the achievement he and his colleagues have wrought, Tim Pickens says, "At heart, we're a bunch of guys wanting to go into space, but we can't afford it."
I've got a clan of gingerbread men. Here are men, there are men, lots of gingerbread.
Isaac Russell will not be able to claim that he attended his first basketball game at the age of 5 hours. But he can claim that his mom, University of Nebraska at Kearney women's basketball coach Carol Russell, coached her team 5 hours after Isaac was born. "I wanted to be there for the girls," Coach Russell said, "because they've been working so hard all year." Russell had not planned to be at the game, conceding that, quote, "the birth of my first child came first." But just before game time, she announced she was going. Once in the gym, she made just one concession to her circumstances. "I usually stand up during the whole game," she said, "but I didn't have the energy." An adventurer from Scotland known as El Loco, I know, and it gets better, El Loco, whose real name is Levon Brown, took 5 months last year to row from Spain to Tobago. Now he's planning to cover a similar route on a surfboard. But he's not as crazy as he sounds because his surfboard will have a sail. No muy loco, ¿verdad?
Crap!
Recognizing that sharks may be an issue, El Loco has arranged for his board to be surrounded by an electrical field that he believes will repel the beasts. "Still, if the weather is wrong, I could be in trouble," El Loco has acknowledged in what may be the most spectacular understatement in the history of ocean travel.
"Sharks patrol these waters. Sharks patrol these waters. Don't let your fingers dangle in the water. And don't you worry about the Dayglow Orange Life Preserver. It won't save you."
You're listening to Only a Game. 6 years ago, NASCAR legend Dale Earnhardt Sr. died in a last-lap crash during the 43rd running of the Daytona 500. The NASCAR world still mourns the passing of the fabled number three, even as it celebrates his contributions to auto racing, his competitive spirit, and his accessibility. On the eve of the Daytona 500 in February, commentator Arlinda Boyer told us how she missed Earnhardt for those reasons and for other reasons besides.
"I may be the only Buddhist who loves stock car racing. Roaring engines and silent meditation have little in common, but truth and wisdom know no boundaries, and when Dale Earnhardt died, I mourned him both as a race fan and as a Buddhist. Earnhardt ruled the Quicksilver Kingdom of NASCAR. 7 times a champion, he was called the Intimidator for his aggressive style, but I think the Intimidator achieved the Buddhist ideals of presence, compassion, and joy. On the track, there is nothing but the car and its driver. The fans are invisible, the environment a mere blur. The driver is alone with his desire, his fear, and his courage, and he must be fully present. Dale carried that presence off the track as well, able to give his full attention to a single person in a room jammed with people waiting to meet him, to let each person feel they'd made a friend. Until his death, the Intimidator image kept his compassion hidden. But our authentic self emerges in moments of crisis, and more than once he leapt out of a wrecked car to make sure a competitor was all right. For me, it was proof of his bodhicitta, the awakened heart of compassion. In one of his last interviews, Dale said, "At the end of the day, I just want everyone to be happy." Though he didn't know it, that heartfelt wish for joy, open and limitless, is the definition of bodhicitta. When he won the Daytona 500 after 20 years of trying, every team that competed against him lined up to shake his hand. It had never happened before in motorsports, and it has never happened since. He said, "I hope everyone gets the chance to feel this way just once in their lives. Again, in moments that cannot be rehearsed, we see a person's true nature, and this generosity of spirit was Dale's. More than anything, Dale Earnhardt taught me joy. Because he risked death every weekend, he loved life all the more, and he lived it fully, fearlessly, with a wide-open spirit. One teaching says, Buddha does not always appear as a Buddha. He can appear in a brothel or a gambling house. My Buddha appeared, not in robes, but in Wranglers, with twinkling blue eyes and a passion for fast cars. My Buddha died on the final lap of the Daytona 500 on February 18, 2001. Goodbye, Dale, and thank you.
He said, boy, do you know how it feels to run three wide?
Arlinda Boyer is a grant writer for the American Shakespeare Center in Stanton, Virginia. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid, GNC, and Duane Reade. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Shakespeare students square off with sonnet and soliloquy. But first, even the most casual observer knows that competitive ice skaters twirl, shimmy, and dance their way to glory. Those who have roller skated recall with affection the cheesy get-ups and the old-timey organ music. But what happens when you combine the two? Only a Game's Karen Given found out this past March.
It's barely 7 on a warm Saturday morning, and the Roller Palace in Beverly, Massachusetts has been buzzing with excitement since 5:30. Call that the relative excitement of the figures competition at the Northeast Regional Midwinter Invitational. If it wasn't for the equipment on their feet, these skaters easily could be confused for their icier counterparts. The women are decked out in sequins and sparkles, short skating skirts, and matching boot covers. The men are in shoulder-to-toe spandex jumpsuits with more than a few sequins of their own. Compulsory figures were the bane of many an ice skater before they began to be phased out in the late 60s. But this morning, roller skaters are carefully tracing over circles nearly 20 feet across, painted three in a row on the Roller Palace's wooden floor. 11-year-olds Amber and Allison are hanging out on the benches to the side of the rink, laughing while the medals around their necks clink together. Like everyone else, Amber is wearing makeup and sequins, but she bristles at the idea that she joined the sport for the sparkly outfits.
Well, I play basketball. Like, I love sports, other sports. And I'm not really a person that likes makeup or dresses, and it's the only time I put on a dress, except for, like, weddings. I just think it's really fun, and that's the only reason I put up with it, Ken.
Allison and Amber's friends at school don't always understand why they spend so much time skating. But when the pair traveled to Nebraska for the national finals last summer, they met skaters from all over the country, and now they want everyone to try it.
It's just really a great experience. And you get to travel all over the place, and it's just really fun.
Like in Australia, Nebraska.
Yeah, Australia.
Yeah,
probably.
For world, if you make it into world. And the more that you go into different competitions, the more friends you get to make.
It's nice because you get to make friends with all different age groups.
Oh, yeah.
Not just the ones you're in.
When Amber talks about making friends in all different age groups, she's referring to kids she might not necessarily play with at recess, not skaters like Colleen Reynolds from Hudson, New Hampshire. But bringing the generations together is exactly why Colleen's here.
I started 6 years ago to compete with my grandkids. But my coach actually is Bonnie Becker. She started with my youngest daughter, then had my grandchildren, then she got Grammy last. So she's had three generations of us.
Colleen didn't just find time with her grandkids at the rink. She also found friends like Cordelia McLeod, Dee Dee for short. Dee Dee's been on roller skates most of her life, but says she left the sport when she discovered boys and came back to it when she became interested in men. And she's never been embarrassed to tell people what she does in her spare time.
People that know me already know that that's my focus, that's my passion. A fellow that had been in my life for a long time. He came to watch me skate for something, and he said, you really like to skate? And I said, yeah, like you like your thing. No, he said, you really like to skate. He said, your face just lights up when you skate. He said, you just love it. This is my exercise. This is my fun. This is my focus of my time.
Dee Dee skates four, sometimes five times a week.
But these days, she's having more and more trouble finding a place to practice. When she was a kid, there was a rink in her town. When that closed, Dee Dee was able to go to larger cities in New Hampshire. Now, as the number of rinks diminishes, so does the number of skaters.
Sometimes we lose skaters because if a rink closes, it's so much farther for someone to go, so it makes it harder and harder. Myself, I live in New Hampshire, and I skate in Massachusetts because there are no longer any rinks in New Hampshire. So I skate in Tingsboro, which is about 40 minutes from my home. I suppose if I had the money, I'd build a rink, but I'm spending my money skating instead.
Some of the morning's events only have one or two competitors. Even the larger groups seem to have no more than five or six. During interviews, people here say their sport is not growing or that it's leveling off. But after the microphone is put away, one man shakes his head and tells me his sport has been on the decline since the end of World War II.
I don't know if this is going to be good enough for her, but...
Walking into the Roller Palace for the evening dance session is like stepping 50 years back in time. Women sit at round plastic tables in front of the snack bar, putting the final touches on their hairspray and makeup. There are men here, too, mercifully excluded from the primping. The skaters compete in age groups, from the 8 and under primary division to the 55 and older veterans. But the kids' dance events are scheduled for Sunday morning, and most of the Saturday evening crowd is closer to 60 than to 16.
This is veteran solo, and you have to be 55 or older to skate it.
Okay.
And men and women can skate.
Dee Dee McLeod is lined up at the far end of the rink, waiting for her turn to compete. The judges will watch her body posture, feet placement, and form as she goes through the pre-choreographed steps of her event. I ask what aspect of her routine she'll be focusing on during her skate. Without losing a beat, she smiles and says, having fun.
Introducing the skaters in flight number 5 from the Roller Kingdom Kingsboro Skating Club, number 268, Cordelia McLeod.
Dee Dee skates first in her group, starting with a short original opening before beginning the prescribed dance steps. Her arms stretch out to her sides, like a ballet dancer, and her feet cross over each other in a smooth gliding motion. Like the other dancers, Dee Dee stares serenely upwards, not watching her feet, and smiles broadly. Dee Dee won't win this event. She won't even place, but it's quite clear she's having fun. Also at the far end of the rink, a professional photographer has set up his equipment, complete with a large fabric backdrop and umbrella lights, just like at a high school prom. It's been a few decades since Bob Quinzani's attended a school dance, but he poses proudly for his photo in a dapper black skating outfit with hot pink trim.
This is a two-piece skating outfit. And it's decorated with sequins and jewels that my wife spends hours and hours and hours putting on there. The idea is to reflect the light that's out there. This is my wife, Gloria. We've been married 49 years in May. We've been skating almost all the 49 years.
You know what? I'm very impressed that you have a husband who's not afraid to wear pink.
Oh, he wears pink. I think it's lovely.
Gloria's quick to point out that one of her pros designed the outfits. Notice I said one of her pros. The Quinzanis employ several people to help them reach their goal of placing at the Nationals. So they must practice a lot, right?
Not enough.
Not really enough. We skate probably at least 3 times a week.
3 times, yeah.
Maybe 4. As it gets closer to Nationals in July, we'll pick up the pace and put in a little more time.
Does it make for a good, strong marriage, all that skating?
We've been married 29 years. That's a long time.
Yeah, without any breaks, huh?
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
Bob and Gloria might not have taken any breaks from skating or each other, but Hal Hermani can't say the same. Hal was a competitive skater in New Jersey in the 1940s. He made the States and Nationals in 1943 and 44. For impact, he reminds me that was the year Franklin D. Roosevelt instituted the March of Dimes.
And then my partner drifted away and got married. So for the next 2.5 years, I skated with Betty Lytell. Do you know who she is?
No.
She's the Sonia Henny of roller skating.
For those who might need a reminder, Sonia Henie won 3 consecutive Olympic figure skating gold medals in the 1920s and 30s. Her success made her a celebrity. It's hard to imagine any of today's artistic roller skaters as celebrities, but to hear Hal tell it, things were different in the 40s.
It was wall-to-wall people just watching. When I skated in the Nationals in Detroit, Michigan, at the Arena Garden, the people were standing, you know, like you would watch a parade. And these weren't the skaters. These were the people who came to watch.
In 1949, Hal left skating to focus on his university studies. 57 years later, at the age of 80, he decided to make a comeback. So far, he's focusing on getting his legs back. But don't worry, Hal says he still has plenty of time.
Well, I've told a lot of people I plan to be the oldest living vet from World War II. That means I've got roughly 20 more years to skate.
I hope they're good skating years.
Oh, it will be. Come next year. I plan to be a winner. And I don't plan to be the only one in the event to be the winner.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Beverly, Massachusetts.
Thank you.
In the lobby of the Tufts Performance and Production Center in Boston, on the day most of the rest of the nation knows as Super Bowl Sunday, stands 6'4" Miles Jacoby of the River School in Weston, Massachusetts, looking like an athlete.
I've been a big sports guy. I mean, played lacrosse, basketball through high school, tried to juggle theater also, because that was kind of my main thing. I tried to do it all.
On this particular afternoon, theater will decidedly be his main thing. Miles Jacoby will do Othello, meaning that he'll recite part of one of Othello's speeches from the play of the same name. Jacoby is one of 10 high school students who earned the right to participate in the Massachusetts state finals of the Shakespeare competition. The winner will advance to the English-speaking Union's national competition in Washington, D.C. in April. Patricia Budenhagen, the president of the English-speaking Union's Boston branch, is perfectly comfortable comparing the advantages of the contest she's overseeing with those of various other more popular competitions.
Whether it's athletics or drama or camera club or whatever a kid gets interested in, I think that focus, hard work, and having a performance to work towards is important, and I think the Shakespeare competition does that for Shakespeare and drama, just as a basketball game gives kids who shoot hoops something to take part in.
Like those who shoot hoops in high school, some of those who memorize and recite Shakespeare as teenagers aspire to greater heights. Lily Narbonne, whose ascent to Sunday's finals began when she impressed the director of a student production at the Bromfield School in Harvard, Massachusetts, wants to work at the craft well beyond college.
Yeah, I would love to have a career in theater, acting. I'd like to try film. Yeah, all I know right now is I really, really want to study theater. It's really what I want to do with my life. I love it.
Some of the students who've made it to this state final have been preparing for this day for at least as long as many high school athletes have aspired to the varsity. Zandra Clark, a junior at the Windsor School in Boston, knew years ago where she one day wanted to be.
I remember my first year coming to Windsor. I was in sixth grade, and this competition is only for sophomores, juniors, and seniors, but I saw them perform it in an assembly. And I was just really inspired by all the older students doing Shakespeare and being amazing at it, and I just wanted to do it.
Zandra Clark's choice of passages came from one of Shakespeare's plays most likely to speak to adolescents, Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, yeah, I chose that. Actually, the ESU sends out a list of recommended monologues, and the Juliet monologue wasn't on it, but I was just sort of wanting to do Juliet because I wanted to do her for a while, and I've just always been so intimidated because it's such a big role, but I just decided to go for it.
Go for it she did, as Juliet, Act 3, Scene 2, lines 17 to 33.
Oh, I have bought the mansion of a love, but not possessed it, and though I am sold, not yet enjoyed.
Besides presenting a character from one of the plays, in the first part of the competition, each student had to recite one of Shakespeare's sonnets. In that category, Lily Narbonne was especially impressive.
Thy eternal sunshine shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, for in eternal lines to time thou growest.
When each competitor had finished with his or her prepared proportion of the program, they all received speeches with which they were unfamiliar. They had 10 minutes to examine the material before reading it to the three judges and the audience of perhaps 100 parents and classmates. When the performances were over, the competitors returned to their seats and awaited the decision of the judges. Lily Narbonne was the third runner-up. Sandra Clark captured second runner-up.
And let's all congratulate Miles Jacoby, the winner.
Miles Jacoby was gratified and humbled by the result.
I think it's a surprise because I thought there were too many talented people in this room for me to win. So, yes, this is a surprise.
Hey, congratulations.
As the competitors and their families and friends filed out into the gray Boston afternoon, the judges talked a little about how difficult it had been to make a decision. One of them, Rob Orchard, the executive director of the American Repertory Theater, maintained that the three arbiters had reached what he called a friendly consensus.
It was. We had plenty of cookies and brownies and hot cider to calm us down.
Pressed, Rob Orchard discussed the criteria that he and his colleagues had considered and even came up with a sports metaphor.
There's artistry to it, of course, and therefore there is a level of subjectivity. There's clearly certain baseline. Can you hear them? Do they understand the words? Do they get the cadences and the poetry down, which is not unlike figure skating in terms of specific things that they have to actually perform in any particular exercise. But it's the artistry part which has a level of subjectivity to it, and we're not perfect. And I can well imagine that people in the audience such as you might have had somewhat different order of finishers here.
Whether that acknowledgement was sufficient to convince the 9 competitors who aren't Miles Jacoby that they weren't victims of outrageous fortune, that things might have turned out differently if only the judges had weeded their judgments of all opinion that grew rank in them, I am not wise enough to say. Regarding the aforementioned Mr. Jacoby, let us speak of the spring and foison of the year. Good luck in Washington this April, Miles. Unhappily, Miles Jacoby did not prevail in the National Shakespeare Competition, but unlike the rump-fed Runyon, he didn't cry. Instead, I think we may assume that Mr. Jacoby, as full of valor as of kindness, bristled his courage up and carried on. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Parati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to peruse our panoply of podcasts, view our many photo galleries, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Hamlet's father. Oh, yeah, I forgot. The rest is silence. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.